forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge, or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Finding Genius Podcast. I have a returning guest. I get his newsletter. His name is John C.A. Manley. He's the author of a newsletter called Blazing Pinecone. Yeah, I get his emails pretty much every day. They range on a whole bunch of topics. John's a pretty thoughtful guy and has commented a lot on, you know, the pandemic. He's commented on, you know, what he sees happening in society and many other factors. And a recent post he had made that talks about the power of daily email and a few other issues caught my attention. So I reached out to John and asked him to come back. So welcome back, John. Thanks for coming.
Al, thank you, Rich. Glad to be back.
Yeah. And just to give a little context, John has written a book called Much Ado About Corona, a dystopian love story. It's a forthcoming book called All the Humans Are Sleeping, and he does other speculative fiction. So we're going to talk possibly about that, and just about his journey over the past few years and his email list and everything. So again, welcome, John. Thank you.
Yeah. Last time I was on the show, I was still working on Much Ado About Corona, and that took me 2 years to write. I thought it would take me 1 year to write, and that took 2 years. I think we talked when I was about 1 year into it, and I thought, I'm almost done. And it took 15 drafts and 1,000 hours. But it was kind of, I started writing what ended up being the sequel first, and then I did so many flashbacks that I realized the flashbacks had become their own novel. So in some ways, even though it took me 2 years, I kind of got most of the sequel done in the process.
Yeah, what did you get out of spending all that time writing? Like, what, now that you look back, what did it do for you besides, you know, putting the book out and getting the word out and everything? Like, personally, what, how did it affect you?
Well, I've never stopped writing that much since then, but it was different because I was working just on one book that was, you know, it ended up being 500 pages. And it makes you realize that if you just keep doing something every day, eventually it would be done. And that was the first thing, because it was going so slow. Like, you come in and work for an hour or 2 hours, and all I did was rewrote a chapter several times and had to do some research on it and come back. And it felt like, you know, you're just chipping away at something so slow that you feel like it's not going to take form. But I just told myself every day I was going to do 2 hours on it, you know, and if I got behind, then I'd do 3 hours, but I'd try to keep ahead. The other thing that surprised me was the more I worked on it, how, like, it surpassed my expectations about what I thought I could produce. I think that was the biggest thing for me, that if I just came in every day and hacked away at it, kind of like a blacksmith just banging at it, you know, that it was going to get better and better. And, you know, I got to this 10th draft and I was like, I don't want to stop. I still got ideas. I found is, like, I'd go and rewrite the whole thing, edit the whole, it was like 150,000 words, go from beginning to end, and it got a lot better. So I go, I'm going to go do this again. And then it get a lot better. I only stopped when it stopped getting a lot better, when it was just like, I was just fixing little things.
Yeah. And what kind of feedback have you gotten on the book that, you know, that maybe hit home or influenced you or made you feel like you did a worthwhile thing?
I've been actually surprised at the lack of negative feedback I got from it, considering how controversial it was, which I think is a good sign, because I think the people who are opposed to it are just ignoring it because they know they can't wrestle with it. But otherwise, I was, you know, the feedback's been very flattering. Like, I knew I liked it a lot. That was the thing. I wrote something I really liked, and it got to the place where I was happy with it, but I didn't know if anyone else was going to. But I mean, one example would be like Patrick Corbett, not to be confused with James Corbett. He's former director for W5, Dateline. He was a Hollywood producer, director, Beachcombers, and I mean, he was just thrilled with the book. I mean, I got a quote here where he says he thought it was a ripping story of courage, awakening, and love with some good laughs thrown in, all in the time of COVID. He said he had trouble putting the book down. And this is a guy who's, like, his career was basically tearing apart scripts and being hypercritical about it. So that type of feedback's come through. I've also been very happy to hear a lot of people were resistant to read it because they didn't want to go back to that horrible time with the lockdowns and the nightmare that we saw coming. Never got as bad as we feared, but thanks to the resistance. But they didn't want to read the book, but once they start, they found it actually therapeutic. I did a good job, I feel, at not making it all grim and dark. There's a lot of humor put in. And I wrote it in a way that it is exposing the COVID hoax, but it's doing, if it didn't cover the COVID stuff at all, it would still be such an enjoyable story that you'd want to read it, just the plot and the characters. So it's not one of those thinly veiled novels that's just really trying to be didactic and teach something.
Right.
And I wanted it to be more about the people resisting than about exposing the hoax, like showing that people didn't have to go along with this and that people didn't, and trying to make noncompliance a little more contagious than the so-called virus.
So what does it tell you that you got very little negative feedback? Is it that the media just portrayed just all lies and making it look like everyone was on the same page, and the feedback you got doesn't seem to support that? Or like, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm surprised. Like, I know I get emails back from like nurses that were in nursing homes and saying that this book described exactly what they were seeing when they were in the nursing home, and they couldn't, and they felt like a part of their brain was split because the authorities were telling them everything they were doing was right and what they saw happening looked wrong. And then this story depicted quite clearly what was happening was wrong. And that, I think, they found a bit liberating. Because you know how it feels if you're, it's a horrible, I think that's what caused more people's stress, was the fact, not that the government was lying to them, but the fact that so many people were going along with it, and they in themselves knew it was wrong, but they just felt they couldn't be the only person who was thinking this way. Like, you know what I'm saying?
I think it created cognitive dissonance. And also I think what it did is it did what called morally injuring people. So like, yeah. Let's say you were a prostitute for 10 years. You know, how could you ever have normal relationship with somebody because of what you've been through, or a stripper, or you're a police officer, or you were in war or whatever. I interviewed a lady that talked about the concept of moral injury, being forced to do things or being put under duress to do things that you believe are wrong, but the act of you doing them screws you up and injures you morally. So I think that's what happened to people.
Maybe that's why so many of them were willing to go along in the end with getting an injection that they were very doubtful was safe, because they almost felt like they maybe deserved punishment.
It could be, yeah definitely. So are you taking the material that you wrote, and is the sequel almost ready? Like, where are you at with it?
Sequel is probably about 50% done. I think it's going to be a trilogy, so that's probably part of the problem. I start working on the sequel and it gets so expanded and epic that it looks like there's going to be three books, so that slowed it down a bit. And then I took a little break because, as you know, my wife passed away when I was working on the sequel, and it was a little hard too, because the two characters in the first book, they get married in the second book, and that was just because, you know, kind of emotionally was a bit difficult to deal with. So I had another novella I'd been working on for 20 years called All the Humans Are Sleeping, which is more of a near future science fiction that deals with freedom, consent, AI, robotics, the metaverse. Takes place after World War III, where like 7/8 of the planet is wiped out, and the humans that are remaining are driven underground and offered this kind of utopian metaverse alternative. And the robots, unlike in The Matrix, for example, where they're all evil, are actually good and kind of become the humans' ICU nurses, until one kind of goes rogue and starts taking the humans out. So it's not so much about being in the metaverse, it's about coming out of it. So anyways, yeah, I decided I'd just work on that. I thought it was almost done. You know, I've been working on it for 20 years, which ended up being like, I doubled the page count on it, and it ended up becoming quite a big project. But it should be out soon. It's with my editor at the moment.
Okay. And then the other part of this that we're going to talk to you is about, again, the Blazing Pine Cone and your daily emails. Like, what are you trying to accomplish with your emails and your newsletter and everything? What are some of the goals you have?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so, it comes down to, it's actually pretty interesting. I found this quote from Adolf Hitler, of all people, which was very interesting. This was written, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, it's German. The fellow's name was Ernst Hanfestangl. He wrote a memoir about, he was a Nazi who had turned against the Führer. And but he said in particular that, and I'm not promoting Nazism by any means here, but you got to wonder, how did Germany go from being the country it was to ideologically changing to the point that, you know, they brought in this fascist regime, assuming all the history is correct. And anyways, Adolf Hitler had actually said, "But how can I hammer my ideas into the German people without a press? The newspapers ignore me utterly. How can I follow up my successes as a speaker with our miserable four-page German periodical, I guess he had, I'm not even going to try to pronounce that, that was just published once a week. I guess it was like the Nazi Party newsletter. And then he went on to say, we'll get nowhere until it appears daily. And he had actually pushed to the point where he was daily putting out information. And again, I also, a blog post I had put up, which if anyone wants to read it, I'll put a redirect link. It's at blazingpinecone.com/daily post. And that was from Stephen Pressfield, who's a historical fiction writer. He wrote a book called Man at Arms about the Roman Empire. And he believed, and he depicts in the story, that what led to the fall of the Roman Empire was the fact that they had daily post. And then that, he said, allowed, how did he put it? It allowed for the...
Before we continue, I've been personally funding the Finding Genius podcast for 4.5 years now, which has led to 2,700 plus interviews of clinicians, researchers, scientists, CEOs, and other amazing people who are working to advance science and improve our lives and our world. Even though this podcast gets 100,000 plus downloads a month, we need your help to reach hundreds of thousands more worldwide. Please visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click on Support Us. We have 3 levels of membership, from $10 to $49 a month, including perks such as the ability to see ahead in our interview calendar and ask questions of upcoming guests, transcripts of podcasts you're interested in, the ability to request specific topics or guests, and more. Visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click Support Us today. Now, back to the show.
The widespread transmission of new and seditious ideas. So the very thing that gave the Roman Empire so much power, being able to, you know, literally deliver mail every day across, you know, multiple countries, which was unheard of at the time, which was largely a result of the highway system, was the exact same thing that allowed people to uprise against the Romans. And then also the theme of this particular novel was to spread the teachings of Christianity. So I think that what we have today, and I think it's being underutilized, is email is probably one of the, I mean, compared to the Roman Empire, where you had to build highways and it would take probably days to get a letter from one place to another, if not weeks, email is almost free and technologically amazing. So I think it's being underused. And I think a lot of people are resistant to mailing their subscribers every day. So I have been doing that now when the lockdown started, I started mailing people every day because I saw immediately that the lockdowns were a hoax and very evil in themselves. And it was evident. So I thought, if I just mail people every day and just give them a little bit of information every day demonstrating why this is wrong, that it would have a big influence. I mean, I was surprised how fast that list grew, because I wasn't really promoting it. And every day I was getting like 20 new subscribers. And I don't know how much influence I had on the entire movement. Obviously, I was one of the first people speaking out, but when it started to catch fire, it caught fire. But I can tell you, I had people emailing me saying that I kept them sane for those first few months of the lockdowns, because people saying they were on the verge of suicide, and my email coming in every day saying, "No, you're not crazy." You know, at the end of every email, I would always write "stay sane," because everyone was saying "stay safe," and I would always end with "stay sane." So, and I mean, I got people now, I've been doing this for 3 years, I guess, and people have been on my email list for 3 years now, and they feel like I get people telling me, you know, if you're ever in this state or this country, you know, their city, you know, just knock on my, you can stay at our place, and trying to invite me, you know, it's like they feel like I'm part of their family almost at times. So that's been very touching. So anyways, that's on that side of it, that's what I'm doing. And I've helped a lot of other businesses, both in the freedom movement and then private entrepreneurs with this also. I think it's a good method, even like if someone has a long form production like yourself with a podcast, you know, if someone has even a once a week podcast, which is like 1 hour, that they could still do daily emails where every day they just quote a little bit from that 1 hour long podcast and send that out to their list. And when they get feedback about the podcast, share that via email and just keep, you know, every day encouraging people to go listen to the full podcast. And if they don't, they still got the little tidbits from it. So
Yeah, I think a lot of people are afraid of bothering people, you know, where they get like one complaint and they freak out. It's like, don't ever email me again. You know, you're in violation of whatever and you ruined my life. And, you know, I've seen that a lot in marketing. And then people go, oh, see, I'm bothering people. And then they don't correspond with anybody. Have you had to deal with that?
Yeah, that's always the fun stuff. I like quoting them sometimes. I'm happy to feed those people off the list because, you know, as you know, if you're paying for an email marketing service, you're paying based on the size of the list and how much emails you send out. So anyone who has that kind of attitude, I'm quite happy to see them go as quick as possible. On the whole, though, I tend to find I've experimented back and forth with once a week before I got into this particular, my publishing business with clients. You know, we've done three times a week, once a week, every day, and far less spam complaints doing every day. And I think it's because if you do once a week, someone signs up and 1 week later you email them, they already forgot they signed up. So bang, this guy's spamming me. But if, you know, you're starting that thing of daily contact right away, they'll either unsubscribe and without complaint or they, because they actually remembered they signed up. So, and it's very hard to build a relationship with people on a once a week basis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, you don't send them like a 2,000 word email every day. That's the other extreme.
Yeah, I do marketing for attorneys and we have a list of like 35,000. We email at, you know, 5 days a week for years and years and years and years. We get a lot of positive comments and people come out of the woodwork sometimes. Hey, I've been on your list for 2 years and, you know, this came up and now I want your help, et cetera. So it does work. People do, you know, a lot of people may not respond, but they're reading, they're getting good stuff out of it is what I've seen.
Yeah, I was surprised. Like I've had people on my list for 2 years, never bought my book, and they finally just bought it. And I can't believe I took this long to buy it. And then they really liked it, which surprised them too, for some reason. But, you know, it just took that. And, you know, the thing is, a lot of us, you know, I see for myself is I got like a pile of books, you know, that I if I didn't buy a book for another 2 years, I'd, you know, be fine because I got so many I, you know, need to get through anyways. So if someone signs up on my list, it's like I don't naturally feel that, you know, they're going to just drop every book they already paid for to go read mine. Yeah, I'm happy if they do, but, you know, it might take a year or two. Or in my case with the Much Ado About Corona, so many people were so traumatized by the whole thing, they don't want to read about the COVID stuff. It's kind of strange. This year, the sales have been really good. I don't know if it's something I've done or it's just the world's changed. But people are willing to go back there and kind of sort out, I think, how they felt about the whole thing. But no, you're absolutely right. I don't think it makes sense. Oh, well, I guess what I was going to say too was, if you got people on your list who are actually like interested in what you offer, whether it's you're selling something or sharing information, and why would they not want to get something every day? And then the people who aren't interested, well, that's fine. They just unsubscribe. I mean, you know, I'd rather have a list that's half the size of people who are eager to read what I have to say than a list that's twice as big and, you know, they maybe just scan the email once a week.
Yeah, one thing we did on holidays, like for Thanksgiving, he wrote up a whole story of how, you know, about the Nina Repenta and the Santa Maria. And we sent that out to my list and they really liked that. We're not selling anything, you're providing a cool story. And then for Christmas, he did a series on Ebenezer Scrooge Esquire, you know, the lawyer, you know, a take on Carol. And then we get a lot of good responses from that because we're not just selling stuff. We're providing valuable content. And again, during the holidays, we just provide cool, heartwarming stories. So the email list doesn't have to just be sell, sell, sell. It could be all kinds of things. You communicate with your people.
Yeah. Especially if you have a philosophy behind what you're doing, whether it's a business or an organization or a media source. If you have a philosophy, then you kind of want to try to share your personal philosophy with your audience. And it's hard to do that in like one go. It's much easier just to drip it, you know, over weeks and months. And I think, would you agree, like by writing frequently, especially every day, it actually makes you more clear in what you're about, what you believe, and what you're trying to do.
Yeah, as I go around town, something happens and I'm like, oh, I'm going to write about it. Or someone pisses you off or you had some experience, like, all right, I'll write about it. So everything becomes fodder for your email list within reason.
Yeah, it's an old saying, you know, nothing bad ever happens to a writer because it's just fodder for his next book or, you know, in this case, an email. So, and I've known people who have actually, you know, done nonfiction books where it was, they were just writing emails. A good example would be, I'm going to forget his name, but he wrote the book Atomic Habits, which is a national, you know.
That's right. James Clear. Yeah.
And that's been probably one of the best-selling books on productivity. I mean, it was on the, I don't, probably still on the Amazon top 100, but it was number, you know, top 10 forever, it seemed. And I think that book seemed largely, and by his own admission, was just, I think he called them blogs, but they went out by emails, and he had just worked on those for years, and then he just put them together as a book, and he did a good job at weaving them together. It wasn't just like a collection of blog posts, but you know, certainly the most of the work was done, I think, by the time he decided to turn it into a book.
Yeah, interesting. So what, I know you're communicating with your audience, but like, what are your goals for your newsletter? Is it to get as much attention on the books as possible? Was it just to be like a personal outlet for yourself? And people enjoy hearing from you, so you want to talk to them, like, just satisfy your desire as a writer? Like, what is the reason you do it?
Number one reason is to sell my books. I mean, my goal is, if I had to choose, you know, my preference would be just to be writing my novels all the time, but I have to sell them. So, yeah, the number one goal is to sell my novels. And I don't know if that sounds good or bad. You know, people's like, selling stuff is a bad thing or something like that. But I do it in a way I feel that I'm, you know, people aren't complaining. They find them, you know, I try to make sure that the emails themselves are preferably all three things: entertaining, informative, and useful. You know, and sometimes maybe one will be more just fun. Some will be a little more on the useful or the information side. But so I'm trying to make sure that I realize they're giving me their time, so I'm going to give them something valuable. And I feel on that way, I'm kind of showing them that if they invest the time in reading my novel, they're going to get something even more valuable. Because I don't think the biggest obstacle to selling a novel is the price. I think it's the time it takes to read it. You know, my novel is 150,000 words, 500 pages. So if you read at a fair pace, you're going to be reading that in 15 to 20 hours, you know, and that's a big chunk of someone's life. And that's great if you're finding it entertaining and you're really enjoying it, you know, why wouldn't you want to do it? But so I'm hoping, you know, via my emails that I'm able to demonstrate that that's what they're going to get if they read the novels. And it's not also, well, I guess my other goal is, like I said, sell novels directly to them, but also for them to buy copies and give it to their friends and family, and then to also spread the word. And then anything else I promote on there is usually just to subsidize my novel writing until I'm not J.K. Rowling yet. So if you know, there's other offers that I think my audience would be interested in, I do promote those on occasion.
Do you have any books? Are they going to be turned also into audiobooks or maybe like a podcast series, you know, that goes through each chapter where, let's say, you read it? Are there any ways you can repurpose the books into more media formats, a movie, whatever it may be, or a video, so that it increases consumption in different ways for people to consume it?
No, I'm definitely working on the audiobook version of Much Ado About Corona. Unfortunately, it's kind of funny with that. For people who have read the book, they'll realize it's a very multicultural book, you know, partly because it's set in Canada and we're a very multicultural country, but the main character himself is part, one quarter Ojibwe, native Canadian. So I had to include some Ojibwe language, which is actually the easiest thing, because Ojibwe, the way it's written, is phonetically very easy to read. It's easier to read, actually, than English. So that wasn't too hard, because they didn't have a written language. So when the words were adopted into English letters, it was just done phonetically. But the other character in the story is German-Canadian, and I have quite a bit of a Schubert song in there. And then it's also set in Northern Ontario, where there's quite a number of French Canadians. So there's a lot of French in the book too. And I am not fluent in either French or German or Ojibwe. So that has slowed me down considerably. I've been taking lessons for quite some time in both French and German to get my pronunciation well enough that I can narrate the book well. I also have to sing some German in the book too, and that's been fun. I thought that's another example of, I just came in every day, got like four lines I got to sing in German. It's not German opera, it's German Lied, Schubert song, because character sings it in the novel, so I got to sing it on the audiobook. And I've gone from, you know, where it's like, I didn't, like, there's sounds in German that don't exist in English. That O with the two dots on top is a nightmare for me.
Yeah, it's hard to know around.
And the So I went from where I was just making my German friends laugh to where they say I can actually sing those four lines and I sound perfectly German and I sound pretty darn good at it. And that's all I can sing in German. And I got weird things I could only say in French. Like, I can say in French, I was once in prison and you came to visit me. And, you know, it's not something I ever will say if I'm like going to France and going through customs. But so that slowed down the audiobook production. Also, I've kind of learned, I was doing everything with a studio local audiobook studio. We actually have in my remote city of Stratford, Ontario, the one of the studios that's used for Penguin Books and a lot of these other ones. That's been rather expensive. I was having him do both the recording and the editing. I've got since then figured out I can handle the editing of it, which is, you know, it's a fair bit of work getting this an audiobook done. It's like for every hour of recorded audio, they say on average you're looking at like 4 to 5 hours of work. So with retakes and editing. So anyways, with All the Humans Are Sleeping, I made a point of not making it so bilingual. So I maybe the first audiobook I put out may be my forthcoming novel, All the Humans Are Sleeping, which I'm also looking at when I get to the final proof of it, just going through and doing the whole audiobook. Because we find when I'm reading the audiobook, even though we've had like 8 proofreaders look at it, there's still like this one little typo that still exists. And by doing the audiobook, I pick it up anyways. So that's the plan there. Your comment about putting it out in like a multi-part series is interesting.
Yeah, like what if it's just, you know what, like, so I don't, when I read, I think I have narcolepsy. I fall asleep. I don't know why. So I listen
deprivation.
I think I sleep enough. Again, I fall asleep, so I listen to everything. I'm very auditory. That's probably why the podcast suits me. And I've seen through making my own books that, you know, Audible, or the audio version usually sells just as much as the physical version. Like what I see is physical books and audio are top two, and then Kindle is way second below that. But that's just for my stuff. But again, like if there's a book that's not on audio, I'm much less likely to read it because my reading is just a problem, you know? I need like bifocals now and all this stuff. So I just tend not to read it if it's not in that format. So the more formats a book is in, the more ways I can experience it, the more likely I am to consume it. Like some people like to watch videos, some people like to listen, some people like to read. So, you know, it's just an encouragement for anyone listening and for you, the more formats you put it in, the easier it is for people to consume it. You know, some people want bite-sized things. So if you break it into chapters, you could send out one chapter to somebody as like a way to get them on the list. You could talk about particular lessons that occurred in a given chapter, or you could serialize it. You could add commentary that may not be in the book. You know, someone can interview you in the chapter. So it's just another way to dimensionalize and squeeze more juice out of the same effort.
Yeah, it's not a big leap, except when they had to learn French and German and Ojibwe.
That's what they're cool. You know who did that too was Rob Inglis. He did the audiobook version for The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. And man, this guy, you know, the Lord of the Rings, the Hobbit, he sounded in like different languages. He spoke different languages. I mean, he's like a voice. He wasn't just an audiobook guy. He's a voice actor. And this guy put in so much work, but it's like a masterpiece, you know, and it's amazing. All the works. I really appreciate that you're learning these different languages and you're singing and you're doing what he did. And that's a tall order.
And then the accents too. Yeah. I mean, I got a funny video online about showing me learning how to do an Irish accent for one of the characters. And there's an Indian character in there. So I said, to learn how to speak in an Indian accent, which I was rather good at. But, I enjoyed, like, I actually have a theater background. So I was not adverse to it at all. And I was kind of funny because when I went to the Penguin Book thing, they're used to working with authors who are working, you know, they get sent from big publishers and the author just shows up and the publisher's paying it for. I was just an indie author. So he was a little reluctant and he got me in the booth and we did the first chapter and he says, he says, most people can't read their own books. They're horrible at it. And you're really good. So I was like, because he's heard people just kill their own books trying to read them. So I was somewhat relieved about that. But I'm like what you're saying there. It's like, for me, it's become like a whole, I have to do it where it becomes like a masterpiece. Like I've worked so hard on the novel that I'm putting that same kind of effort into the book, the audiobook version. I actually did audition because you can go on the Audibles and have people audition for the book. And I went through, I think about 15, 20 people auditioned. And I just couldn't bear the thought of any of them reading it because I didn't like their auditions. And some of them are very professional authors. I'm not professional narrators. But I think part of the problem was I know the story so well. You know, I've rewrote it 15 times and spent 1,000 hours on it. And I know the characters. An audio, it'd be like handing a script to somebody and telling them that's never, like, let's say, I don't know, they're going to do King Lear. And they've never read King Lear before. And just handing them the script, go on stage and perform it. They're not going to do a great job. I don't care if they're, you know, kind of Brana or whoever. It's just not going to.
What if you did a dramatized version where you're one of the characters and maybe you have other people do the other characters? That might be really cool.
Oh, I'd love that. I'd love that. It would cost a fortune to put together, so I'm going to have to wait till I sell more books.
Well, if you have friends that are willing to do some of the other parts, you know, they could do that, and it won't. Maybe they would do it for you for free for the fun of it.
Yeah, well, I like I said, I was having enough trouble with the professional. The professional narrators weren't up to my level, so I would, you know, need people who are professional actors. I'd have pretty high standards, and like your other suggestion about, you know, seeing it as a, I've had so many people tell me they want to see this as a movie or a TV series, and that they think it would translate very well into that. And I agree. I mean, it would be wonderful to see it as in a screenplay format. But I don't think I could just turn over it as an option. Like, I would have to be in charge of the script. I wouldn't even mind if someone wanted to adapt the script, but I would have to okay it. And Ray Bradbury was the same. That's why there's hardly any movies done of Ray Bradbury's books, because every time he gives them the option and they write a script and he'd read it and I don't like it, and then he'd send it back. So that's why you don't see many, you know. Yeah. Fahrenheit 451 was never turned into a movie.
I just wonder if there's a trade-off, though. You know, like, you want it to be, you know, to your standard, but if it means getting it out to a lot more people and it's not quite what you want, is that acceptable? I guess every author has to wrestle with that and either, you know, like, decide where they want to set the limit.
Yeah, and I'd be flexible enough. Like, I wouldn't even mind if they want to try a different interpretation of it, as long as, you know, this doesn't lose the essence of it. So it would be a hard decision for me. I'd have to, I'd prefer probably just to write the script myself. So, you know, that'd be quite fun. I was actually, someone had suggested turning it into a more of an animated production, which I kind of like the sound of that also.
Yeah, that'd be really cool. Okay.
All the Humans Are Sleeping, I think, would do really well as an animated production, just because of the sci-fi feel. I mean, the story is set both in Manitoba, in northern Canada, on Baffin Islands, and then the second act of the story is all set in northern Norway after World War III. So on-site locations, it would be an expensive movie to put together, but I'd be okay with either. But I could just see it being done so well as like one of those Japanese-style animations where it just has that kind of surreal feel to it.
Yeah. Well, I have compulsive advice-giving disease, so that's why I gave you those suggestions. I try hard to control it, but it doesn't work all the time.
Well, hey, like I said, you know, I agree with you about what you're saying. Is like, if you can get it on something like this onto the screen, you're going to reach a lot more people. And then that will in turn sell more books anyways, because good chunk of people, like when Lord of the Rings hit the movie theaters, it opened the actual books up to a whole new audience. I think people who would never have read the book ended up reading the book after seeing the films.
Yeah. Well, very cool. So for listeners that want to join your list, I recommend it. I love all the things that you write about. Very diverse, very varied and interesting. Where can they go to sign up for your email list?
Yeah. And if they do, they actually get free chapters from Much Ado About Corona, which actually includes the audiobook version too. So they can actually hear the prologue and chapter one being read. Plus, I've created a few audio video trailers that have illustrations that aren't even in the novel itself yet. So, I mean, they can get all that if they go to blazingpinecone.com/subscribe. Or if you just go to the homepage, you'll just click on the subscribe button or add at the bottom for it and enter your email address, and you'll immediately get the two trailers plus the prologue and chapter one. Just sit back and listen. And then you'll get an email from me every day, whether you like it or not. Hopefully you like it. And if you don't, you just unsubscribe. You can send me and if you want, you can send me a nasty email too, but then I'll probably publish it the next day.
Hey, that's funny.
Yeah, well, that's a fun. I mean, some of the crazy things I get from people, it's quite entertaining. So can't take it personally.
If people want to buy the Much Ado About Corona book, you know, to support you and just to have the physical book too, where can they go to do that? Is it on Amazon and everywhere? Or have they blocked you? Like, what's happening?
No, Amazon never blocked me. I was actually, for a while there, on Amazon Canada, it was in the top 10 best-selling dystopian novels for a little while there. It was right between 1984 and Brave New Normal or something. But yeah, Amazon won't let me advertise on them. They said my book had something in it they didn't think was sensitive enough because of the Ukraine war, which I didn't understand the connection at all to the Ukraine war, but they won't let me advertise the book, but it's definitely, they let me sell it. So yeah, it's available through any Amazon. If you go to my website and click on the book and then the order page, I have links to everywhere it's available online, no matter, including Mexico and different countries. It's available in ebook format, paperback, and hardcover. And I also include a link there if you want to just get it from your local bookstore. You can also do that. You just, it'll show you the information you have to give the bookstore. And it's also people are getting it in the public libraries, which has been really nice to see both in America and Canada. I'm not aware of it anywhere else, but I got instructions there if you do want to have it come through your public library.
Yeah, that's great. Excellent. Okay. Well, John, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast, and you're going to keep on writing. So I'd like to have you back when you have some, you know, an additional work that you want to highlight. But thank you for what you do, and for your emails and for your books. And, you know, you have contributed to society. You've helped, you know, that directly. And I just want to thank you as well. So thank you for coming.
Thank you very much, Richard. I appreciate that.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius Podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius Podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at FindingGeniusPodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.